Hi, Patrick. Hi, to Alex as well.
Hello, Khaleesi. Good evening. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, my absolute pleasure. So, hi to everybody on listeners. I'm looking forward to a great space today. We're just waiting for some of our guests to join, and then we'll get started.
Yes, and we're very pleased, very fortunate, actually. Tony Gosling, veteran journalist, also a veteran Bilderberg watcher, correspondent, is fresh off the ground from the Bilderberg meeting this year. So he was right there in the thick of it, as he is most years. So Tony's going to be joining us in a few minutes. So we'll bring him up. It'll be his first time on Twitter Spaces. So hopefully there's not too many technical hitches. But we'll endeavor to get Tony up on stage, and Tony's going to give us a quick summary of this year's Bilderberg, and then he'll take some questions initially from our panelists, for any of the panelists that we bring up. And if we have time before he leaves, he has about 45 minutes with us. So it's informative because Tony knows exactly who went in and who went out, not just this year but previous years. He has a good idea of what was, what the agenda, which they're covering. He's got sources on the ground. He's a really great source for Bilderberg. And Tony's also a great student of history and geopolitics. He's British. He hails from Bristol in the UK, and he has a very successful long-running radio program, independent radio program in the UK as well. Former BBC or BBC trained. Maybe he'll talk about that back in his early days. But yeah, so a real stalwart of the independent media is going to be joining us in a couple minutes. So so Tony, we'll have our time with Tony, and this is going to be really important to really understand what the Bilderberg Group is, and what their agenda is, every 12 months. So we'll get some good perspective on that. And I'm sure Alex will be able to, offer a couple of good questions to Tony Gosling as well, and some of our other speakers as I bring them up. And then after that, we're going to open this up into a forum discussion about where global power lies. So we have the Bilderberg Group, the World Economic Forum, the WEF in Davos. That has kind of emerged as a real point of interest, of course, during and after the so-called pandemic. The WEF is it looms large in terms of agendas, talking points, globalist discourse. So there's that, plus the G7, and also maybe we'll discuss that in the same format with the G10 and the G20. But the G7 mainly has emerged as a sort of embryonic Western consensus body. So we'll talk about the after Tony signs out with us. We'll talk about, well, we want to compare the relationship or the power ranking, if as it were, between Bilderberg, WEF, and G7. What each of them do, what they represent, what they, what they mean politically and geopolitically going forward. It's my assumption and my understanding that all of these globalist confabs are embryonic components of a global government in the making. So we could say embryonic institutions of an embryonic global government going forward. So, and they're building consensus, they're creating policy, they're determining national policies. They're streamlining and normalizing certain things across different countries, as we saw during COVID, and the vaccine rollout is a good example, but also in foreign policy with Ukraine. We could also throw NATO in there as also a conversation piece, because NATO is becoming more of a political organization. The rhetoric from Jens Stoltenberg in recent years, it's becoming more and more political. They're talking about NATO like it's a political entity, that it has territory, NATO territory and NATO values, and NATO has this raison d'être to defend and spread democracy. Very different from a defensive alliance as it was conceived nearly 80 years ago. So that'll also be part of the conversation. But I'll pass it to you for a moment, Khaleesi, because I'm going to try to bring Tony Gosling onto the call now.
Perfect. Thanks, Patrick. And could you just add the second co-host? He's on the panel, please. And if I can just ask everyone to retweet the space at the bottom, there's a share button. And if you press that and just share the space, that'd be great. So I've been listening to Patrick. He does a radio show. I'll pin the tweet in a second, actually, a daily radio show. And there's been a lot of coverage of these topics that we're going to talk about today. Patrick's spoken about these at length. So if anybody wants more detail, it is quite phenomenal. He has really interesting guests. And there was a lot of talk about Zelensky going to the Arab League and, you know, turning up at the G7. And what this means. So I'm glad that we're going to be touching on NATO too. Hi, Jam. The Economic Forum and how they all link together. What are your initial thoughts on it, Alex?
Well, kind of what Patrick already had mentioned. You know, I'm not very, very, very well versed on Bilderberg. I know about them from what I've read from Tony Gosling and from Daniel Estulin. But clearly, you know, these are world, quote-unquote, elite players. I only think that at this stage they're not really defining policy. I think it's more like they're flailing because the most important agendas that they have deployed in the last 3 years are all coming apart at the seams. And so I think that they must be probably very nervously discussing contingency plans. And I think that they are in a very unenviable position, and a lot of bad things can happen and not much good for them.
So where it's interesting that you don't think they're an organization that defines policy. Let me just bring Jade Dyer up as well. I see he's joined us. But
it's okay. It's okay, Khaleesi. You keep going. I will put everybody up. Don't worry.
Thank you. Alex, which of the four...
Sorry to interrupt you. I don't think that they're defining policy at this particular meeting in Lisbon. They used to be. I think that right now they're just like scrambling to salvage whatever they can salvage. I didn't mean to say that they're not people who are into running the world. I just think that they're past their due date.
Yeah, no, I understood. But Alex, when we look at Bilderberg, the World Economic Forum, G7, NATO, I think Patrick mentioned, which do you think is the most influential in terms of defining policy and influencing the others, if you had to actually give them a ranking?
Well, I would say the World Economic Forum is probably more influential, but I don't know. You know, there's Trilateral Commission, there's the Chatham House, the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm not really sure. You know, there are darker organizations also in the banking sector and the Bank of International Settlements. It'll be hard to know which ones are the most influential. I think that Bilderberg probably is not as influential as some of them.
Thanks, Alex. I agree. And hi to Jay and Mats Nilsson. Thanks so much for joining us. I see your hand was raised, Mats, so let's go to you first. How are you? And please do go ahead and chime in.
Yes, thank you. No, I would just like to say, since we're actually able to speak about Bilderberg and the WEF and the G7, and we know so much about them, I would agree with Alex and Jay and say they are not the ones running things. As a legal historian, I like to look at year and decade and 100-year-old facts. And I would actually say that the first traces about how this Anglo-American empires started to build, we can go back to the international cartels of the World War I era. We can go back to Cecil Rhodes. We can go back to that time and place. And today, I would say we have to look beyond these three organizations and look deeper into the Trilateral Commission and the City of London and the Vatican and the shakers and movers of Washington, D.C., the ones that we can't read about because they are off radar. So actually what we're discussing here today is what they allow us to see, what they allow us to discuss. And I can return later to some other findings that's around in the old books from the 40s and 50s and 60s and what's evolved from there. But thank you for now, and thank you for having me.
Khaleesi, yeah, thank you, Matt. And Khaleesi, we're going to be joined by Tony shortly. He's just finishing something up now, and he'll be joining us in just a few minutes. So we can continue to kind of have this forum discussion on these institutions. I think is Jay Dyer, has Jay weighed in on this yet?
Yeah, I'm here.
I was just going to go to Jay. Thanks for that, Matt. And I did have a question for you, which I'll come back to, Matt, in a second. But Jay, thanks for joining us. What are your thoughts, Jay, on so the question I asked is that there's so many different forums going on at the moment. Which do you think are the most influential? And you heard Matt's response, and it's very interesting because he said there are, you know, those things that we're allowed to speak about. I'm assuming those are the things that are made public. And there's a lot behind the scenes that we don't know. But what are your thoughts on it, Jay?
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly which of these entities is really above the other, because so many of them, you know, have the same people in a kind of a revolving door going to the others. There's a great chapter in David Rockefeller's memoirs. It's chapter 27. I just did a talk on this the other day. It's probably the most relevant in the entire book. And he gives the whole history of his family's relationship to setting up these entities. So I think that the previous commenter was correct when he noted that, you know, there were several entities behind the creation of Bilderberg, behind the creation of the European Economic Community, behind the creation of the World Economic Forum, the, you know, Davos. All of that was preceded by families, preceded by the Rhodes Trust, preceded by the British South Africa Company, British East India Company. All of those are really the origins of the modern corporate secret structure of government that we have today. And they definitely tie into the entities like the Vatican. In fact, I just got in the mail the other day Cecil Rhodes' Last Will and Testament, which is a fascinating little work, which outlines, you know, the plans of this group in the late 1890s. So at least the late 1890s, you know, we have the origins of what would be this Anglo-American power structure that would set up you know, satellites like the State of Israel, that would set up satellites in the U.S. in terms of steering committees that would eventually pretty much co-opt and control the U.S. So really, these are all adjuncts and circles within circles of the same entities. But the center of it, according to Quigley, was, you know, the Milner, Rowland Super International Affairs, Fabian Society, Chatham House. The U.S. equivalent is Pratt House, and, you know, they kind of tell these groups what to do. So it kind of trickles down into these steering committees. I think that Bilderberg is probably not as important as it was some decades back, but it still obviously has a lot of power and influence because it's a lot of the same people. They really handed over Bilderberg to the tech elite in about 2014 or 15. I remember writing articles about Bilderberg at that time when they had people like Regina Dugan, I think, going from Google or DARPA to Google or something back and forth. And then she went to Bilderberg and she said, you know, the future is microchips, implantables, wearables and all that. That's what they were saying in 2014. Here we are almost 10 years later. And that's essentially where we are with, you know, Kufid and Stabbies and nanotech and all of this, where they want to push the tech in the next 5 to 10 years. Same stuff. It's all a bunch of AI being discussed this year. So it doesn't really matter how widespread Bilderberg becomes known or Davos, because I think they've entered the era where they don't mind uncloaking. They don't really care if people talk about it because the entities themselves kind of keep going. In fact, somebody mentioned the BIS, which is a key thing to mention. Nobody ever talks about the Bank for National Settlements. They're pushing the, you know, the CBDC. So you had that gigantic triple chin guy from the BIS saying that you're going to have a CBDC, central bank digital currency. You'll have a wallet that we give you and we'll shut it off when you say what we don't like. So, I mean, he says it. He said it like a few months ago. That's the plan. Total control. and rereading David Rockefeller's chapter on Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission and all these things being set up, he says it's for this. He says it's for the creation of an international corporate government that is private, secret, non-accountable to anybody or anything, and it's for the purpose of technocracy. And they all say it and have said it for over 100 years in all these books. So that's what it's all about. That's where we're going. Klaus is just another face of this. He used to be steering committee of Bilderberg, as I'm sure you guys know. So I think that if we really want the shadow players. It's City of London. It's the, you know, the secret banking structure that exists. It's the shadow banking. It's the Bank for National Settlements, which is the central bank of central banks. So that's what I would say.
Thanks, Jay. Thank you so much. And I'd like to deep dive into that. I believe Tony Goslin has joined us on the panel. So we'd like to go over to Tony first. Tony, thanks so much for joining us. The mic button is on your bottom left-hand side. I don't know if you can unmute yourself and just say hello.
Yes, and now I've got a Twitter app installed on my...
I think we can hear you fine, Tony. Just speak again. I think we lost you towards the end.
To Cecil Rhodes. At the end of the 1900s, the British Empire had this arrogant attitude.
I don't know, Jam and Patrick, are you able to hear?
I think Tony's cutting in and out. So I think what we'll do is it's not a good connection. So what we can do is drop Tony down and bring him back up again.
I'll do that now. I'm just taking him off and bringing him back up. Patrick, if you could just send him a message in the background, please, maybe he can, if it doesn't work a second time now, maybe you can press his app. Let me see. Oh, there we go. Okay, maybe he can shut his app and restart it if it doesn't work. Jam, could you bring him back up, please?
Yeah, I'm trying. He just left. He's going to come back.
What's been going?
It's a glitch. I think Twitter's had an update today, and I know
being evicted. So they've set up a society which is, trying to punish ordinary people, the middle class.
Jay, I just want to go back to what you've said. So what you've described was a vast network, some more influential than others. You mentioned Chatham House, and Chatham House is least spoken about, I'd say. So you hear, World Economic Forum and, Bilderberg occasionally, G7 is in the media all the time. But Chatham House, the power that it holds is rarely spoken about. And right. Let's not forget these little, So I just want to ask you in terms of the power that Chatham House specifically holds, because I'd say that if I went on a space and mentioned Chatham House, people would be least familiar with it or even probably not have known what it is and how it influences policy.
Right.
So if you could just expand on that, and then we can go to Zwadan, who's joined us. Thank you for joining, Zwadan. So, Jay, over to you first, please.
Right, so essentially, this is the idea for a kind of inner corporate governance where the inner party is not really known to the masses or to even necessarily the outer party. Cecil Rhodes came up with the idea from studying the Jesuits. Now, it's not a Jesuit conspiracy in the sense that Jesuits control it, but he is very explicit that he really liked the idea of their structure and even incorporating kind of a cell model at times. And so he came up with the idea of 12 inner core people who would function as a kind of roundtable group, pulling from Arthurian mythology. And then to the outside of that, you have what they call the Society of Helpers. And this is 1,000, 2,000 academics that are recruited into under the auspices of the civilizing of the world at that time, right? So this is British Empire period. The idea is let's recruit people to come into this. And they're recruited from Eton, Cambridge, Oxford, et cetera, for the purpose of, as we said, advancing the British imperial civilizational structure. However, the real designs were, according to John Ruskin and others, the sort of inner clique involved in this, was the establishment of a world Fabian, eventually Fabian Socialist Federation. So Lord Lionel Curtis writes a book called The Commonwealth of God, where he says that we're going to have to establish a kind of global federation of democracy, and eventually democracy gets dispensed with for Fabian socialism, and that's due to the influences of the Fabian socialists on Lord Milner, one of the key figures in this inner core. And so they come up with the idea of setting up what they call roundtable groups, and these are just it's just steering committees, right? Again, using the Arthurian model. So the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which goes back to sort of the Royal Society and the idea of sending out imperial, you know, geologists and people to go out and scout for the empire, and probably also to do a little bit of spying on the side. The same idea is used as a model for setting up steering committees. So whenever you hear these names of things like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, they're all structured on the same circles within circles model. And that's why many of the same people attend the same groups. And these are the same people, by the way, that established the British security services, right? They come out of the wartime, sure. But the real establishment of, for example, British intelligence was Lord Cecil, Lord Salisbury, right? Same guy. And he's from this same group of the, what they call the Cecil Block or the Milner Group. And the idea here was that the best way to bring America back into the sway of the British Empire, even though the British Empire is basically dying, would be to have this inner secret core governance, corporate governance, and to make alliance with the wealthiest families in the United States. That's exactly what they did. Rockefellers, Vanderbilt, J.P. Morgan, et cetera. They created essentially corporate governance. And so Chatham House, which has the rule of, you know, Chatham House rules, you don't speak about what is talked about at Chatham House, becomes the basis for the New York version of that, which is Pratt House. So Pratt House is set up. This is a lot of people from the Pilgrim Society, one of these inner Milner groups as well. And these are the same people involved in setting up the American OSS and CIA. So you can begin to see that the exact same structure of how the governance in the secret corporate model is done in the UK is literally just copied and pasted onto the US, right? And it's the same families, the same elites, the same oligarchs, and they all share the exact same view of Malthusianism, neoliberalism, technocracy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think they initially believed in technocracy. I think that's something that gained acceptance later on. You had some visionaries like H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell, who amongst the Fabians did like this idea of technocracy. And then it kind of fell out of favor, and then it becomes more and more popular, particularly after Brzezinski writes Between Two Ages. So that's definitely the time when you can, you know, you can say this is definitely the dogma of this empire for sure. And it's what Brzezinski talks about as the American empire. It's the same thing. That's who controls the Anglosphere 100%, and they still control it. So hopefully that makes sense, and there's some kind of context to what Chatham House is, what Pratt House is, and these are, I think, are the inner people who, you know, the CFR, for example, you know, they hand the policy to the politicians. This is why it doesn't matter who you elect, they're going to be doing what they're told by these people. That's why this agenda never stops. Doesn't matter how many rascals you throw out, this marches forward.
Thank you very much, Jay. Great context, and also the transatlantic aspect of it, the Anglo-American tag team, geopolitical tag team wrestling match, stars, all stars, amazing. Tony Gosling, we've got him back. We're going to give this a go again. Reintroduce Tony Gosling, veteran journalist, broadcaster, hails out of Bristol, in the UK, and Tony is a veteran of Bilderberg as a watcher, correspondent, independent journalist. He's fresh off the ground from a stint at this year's Confab. Tony, welcome to the stage.
Well, thanks very much, Patrick.
And so, Tony, I'll hand over the mic to you. And you know, everyone wants to know a little bit about Bilderberg. So I know you tried to speak earlier. There was a technical glitch. So if you'll just restart again.
Well, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Fantastic. Well,
I think if you switch his, look, Tony, are you on Wi-Fi?
It's been a fascinating.
I'll give it a second. And for the people that are requesting the mic, thank you so much for joining us, firstly. And at the top of the space, Patrick outlined that initially it will be a panel discussion, as we have Tony for a short time. And then after that, we will open it up for other listeners to come up on the panel and ask questions. So that is why, for the moment, we're only taking the pre-agreed panelists. Thanks, Luke.
Just quickly, Khaleesi or Jem, are you able to chat with Tony on the back line to see about his connection, whether he's on a cell connection, whether he's on a Wi-Fi connection, what the problem might be?
I tried. Okay. I tried sending him a message, but I don't think he read it.
Okay.
So maybe if you tell him to check his messages, I can guide him.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, Tony, if you're listening, check your DMs. We're trying to work out what the technical problem was. We'll see if we can sort this out or not. And if not, I think we'll just, proceed forward. I wanted to get, Alex Craner's, take on this. So Alex, we're looking at, the different, confabs, the different organizations, and we're also looking at how these meetings translate into policy. And for Bilderberg in past years, it's been captains of industry, you see banking, software. And as new technologies come along, you start to see people like Palantir, on the guest list and on steering committees in 2012. You start seeing the Facebook representatives. So as social media is in the ascendancy, then big data after that. And now it's AI. So banking and finance, of course, looms large, Alex, as one would expect. Oil, gas, energy. These are also, big features there. Just your kind of assessment on that. I'm comparing Bilderberg to, let's say, WEF, which seems to be more of a think tank in some ways. But Bilderberg, actually, you have elected representatives there. You have ministers there in their capacity, or not in their capacity as elected officials or ministers, but still there seemingly trying to make policy behind closed doors. As Jay said, Chatham House rules. Nobody knows quite for sure. Your thoughts on this, Alex Craner?
Yeah, thank you, Patrick. Well, I think that Jay's summary of the power structures was actually spot on. And so I think that the actual policy directions are coming from way above, higher than Bilderberg. I think that Bilderberg is more the captain level policymakers, where they coordinate how to implement the given set of policies. And I think that Bilderberg at this point is more a little bit aspirational, if I can say it that way, where, I think it's what David Rockefeller once formulated in his memoirs as the need to create these organizations of influential and powerful families in the Western world, just kind of to make sure that everybody's on the same page and that everybody's pulling in the same direction, but they're not defining the direction. You know, if somebody there started to get creative and say that this is all wrong, we should be doing it in a different way. Maybe we should be giving people freedom of speech. Maybe we should rethink the fossil fuels. Maybe we should aim for real democracy. They would be out of that club that day, you know. So it's not. I think it's a gathering of the adept, of the people who are already loyal to the agenda. And the agenda, I think it's always very useful to go back to what George Soros told us last May when he was speaking to the Davos gathering. It was May 2021, I think, in which he said that basically we're seeing a conflict between two models of governance. And I think this is really important to keep in mind. It's two models of governance. It's not the United States versus China, United States versus Ukraine, democracy versus tyranny, you know, capitalism versus communism. It's basically two models of governance. And whatever George Soros said afterwards is irrelevant because he was muddying the waters. But basically the two models of governance that are in conflict today is basically the imperial colonialist system that was created, well, perfected and refined by the British Empire, transferred over to the United States. But it was created, you know, it's a simple predatory system that has a very, very long history. And in our Western civilization, it has continuity going back to the 13th century Venice. And so I think that their agenda is relatively simple to understand once you realize that it's entirely based on the money system, that it needs to constantly expand this fractional reserve credit creation, because every time they extend credit to somebody, they put them in debt servitude, and because that debt has to be paid back with interest, it's a Ponzi scheme, which then requires constant expansion. The system is powerful and stable so long as it expands. The minute it starts to stagnate or even reverse, go into a depression, it starts to come apart. And so it's the logic of the imperial system that has to always expand, that it cannot tolerate rivals, and that it has now come against the brick wall of Russia and China. And so, you know, I think that the discussions among the good and the great are how to save their system and how to not get destroyed by the new powers that are rising, and how to keep it together, because more and more nations are now de-dollarizing. They're considering defaulting on their debt obligation to the Western financial institutions, which will wipe out the collateral, which is essential for them to keep the credit impulse going. And so basically you have a house of cards that is falling in on itself. And I think that the people who are gathering at Bilderberg, Davos, everywhere else are mainly focused on how to keep the system from completely disintegrating.
Thank you, Alex. And Alex is editor of The Naked Hedgie, by the way. So if you're listening right now to this space, click on Alex's icon there. It'll take you, and make sure you're following him on Twitter. And also the same with Jay Dyer. Jay's analysis, an incredible resource bank for everything that we're talking about and more today. And I would say the same for Mats Nilsson as well. Mats is a great Twitter account and essential news feed for me every day. And also, David Vance has also joined the stage. We'll come to David in a bit. But we're going to go third time lucky with Tony Gosling. So, Tony, if you unmute and take it away.
Yeah, well, can you hear me okay this time, Patrick?
So far, so good.
Okay. Well, let's not tempt fate. But anyway, look, there's another aspect to Bilderberg, and I think we really must, look at the evil involved here. Look at what's happening in Ukraine right now. The lies that are coming out about how Ukraine has got to win is just simply destroying the nation. It's destroying a whole generation, maybe two generations, of the population, particularly the men who are being, many of them anyway, press ganged into fighting. So, you know, you've got an unwinnable war. And yet they're being told, go, go, go. It's rather like the sort of World War One scenario, isn't it? That, you know, people are being just sent to their deaths, effectively. And so we must take, I think, a step back and look at the, you know, this is a kind of good and evil thing. The reason I got interested in it, Pat, originally, is digging out some of the original source material on what is Bilderberg, who are they? Enthusiastic members of the SS and in the early days of the Nazis, in the early days of the SS. And then he married into the Dutch royal family. But it was I suppose it was seeing that this ex-SS officer had been the chairman of these conferences for the first 20 years until 1975 that really made me look at this as something a little bit deeper than just some sort of political lobbying group that liked to keep, things under the carpet a little bit. And this Nazi aspect to it, I then started to look. I was helped by various other researchers. Very sad to talk about last week on UK Column, the passing of Dave Barmby, because I worked very closely with him about 7, 8, 9 years ago in tracking down some of the origins of the why it was called the Bilderberg Conference. In fact, I was commissioned to write a book about it by Pluto Press in 98, and I went to London to say, look, I don't know enough about it to write a book. So I've since done that with Dave's help. And we've absolutely connected the Bilderberg Hotel, where they had the original meeting, to this battle in the Second World War, Operation Market Garden, made famous by the film A Bridge Too Far. And it's basically an in-joke, because Lord Carrington, who was in that battle sitting in a tank, plus various other characters, including Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, threw that battle. And they made sure that the Allies lost it, and many British paratroopers at Arnhem were sacrificed. And this was a deliberate act in order to give the Nazis an extra few months to squirrel away their wealth around the world, because they intended to create a Fourth Reich, a financial Fourth Reich, Patrick. And that was why that they chose this hotel in Oosterbeek in Holland, the Bilderberg Hotel, because this hotel represented, it's right next to the place where the British troops in that battle had been massacred because they'd been betrayed by their own side, the British Army. And so from that hotel, of course, all these other meetings came. This was an in-joke, really. And that area where the British troops were being massacred was described by the Germans as the Hexenkessel. And it's still talked about by the Dutch as the Hexenkessel, which is the witch's cauldron, where the British were killed. So this slowly but surely, with Dave's help and others, I made this connection, a very strong connection between this battle in World War II, which extended the war and enabled this wealth to be secreted into Switzerland, into South America. And then it was laundered through the Sullivan and Cromwell's, the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York. And Martin Bormann, who many say died, but he didn't. He was over in South America. Paul Manning writes about this in his book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, creating 750 companies to put this the loot from World War II into those businesses. And often this was the cheekiest trick of all. The chutzpah is unbelievable. They were putting Jews in charge of some of these firms, many of the firms, in order to disguise the fact that these companies, these Fourth Reich businesses, were actually funded through the loot of the Nazi occupation of Europe in the Second World War. And I think it's pretty clear to me that the NATO and Bilderberg went together. They were created around about the same time, NATO a little bit further. But then they realized in the NATO countries that they needed to do this classic thing, which is to keep the Russians out of Europe, to keep the Americans in Europe and the Germans down. And so that's what NATO was about. And that's what Bilderberg was about, making sure that politicians with those sympathies were installed right across Europe. They were really worried. I mean, obviously, many people know that the Italians and the Greeks were virtually communist countries at the end of World War II. They'd become very, very left wing. And so a lot of the CIA's initial efforts were putting in, and obviously the coup in Greece to doing that. Anyway, so Bilderberg is in the background of all of this, making sure that those NATO aims are kept to. And then my book is called The Traitors of Arnhem, really explains the details of how I know that these specific individuals who then later became chairman of the Bilderberg conferences, often also secretary generals of NATO, were involved in throwing this battle in the Second World War. So for them, they were looking at it, Bilderberg, we know why it's called Bilderberg, nobody else does. Well, thanks to Dave Barmby and my research, hopefully more people realise why it's got this title and how it's absolutely unbelievably connected with the whole NATO project, which is now causing death and misery, really right around the world. A lot of people are looking at this thinking, I was chatting with some police here actually in Lisbon earlier in the week, saying, are you going to be volunteering to fight the Russians? And they're laughing, no, not me. know. And, you know, this is, of course, an absolutely diabolical war, an evil war. And I think at the end of it, Michael Hudson puts this quite well. It's really a war against, in Ukraine, is really against, we're two different systems. We were just hearing about the finance capitalism. You know, yes, Alex, you're absolutely right. It needs to keep going. And if it doesn't keep going, it starts to stall. It's, you know, there are serious problems. The other system, which the Russians and, you know, the others, the Chinese, you know, they are saying, well, we're going to have an elected government, obviously not in China, but certainly in Russia, that that controls the infrastructure of the country, that governs the laws. In finance capitalism in the West, in Europe now, the United States of Europe, Britain and the United States in the NATO countries, what they've got is actually a dictatorship, a financial dictatorship, where the media is bought up by finance capitalists. If they're in the way, the politicians are bought up. And David Lammy at this Bilderberg conference is a perfect example of a lapdog of the financial elite. He will do almost anything they say. And when he becomes foreign secretary in the next, by the way, my inside sources have told me, and these are people that work in government, that the Conservatives don't want to win the next election because they know there's going to be a financial collapse in, they reckon, around about 2 years' time, and they want the Labour Party to be in charge so that they can take all the blame for it in a couple of years. So the Tories are doing everything they can to make sure in Britain that they don't get in. And Lammy will be the foreign secretary at that point, almost certainly. And there he is, really doing everything he can to bend over backwards to be the person they want him to be. He's not his own man. He is one of the creatures of Bilderberg. And I'm afraid most of Europe's politicians are creatures of Bilderberg these days.
Oh, that's great insights there, Tony. You also brought up a really important point regarding NATO. I like to describe it, and NATO is the glove which America can slide its hand into to steer European political, economic, and military geopolitical affairs. But also the other point you brought up, which is really important, was after the Second World War, all those 700 companies formed a kind of transnational corporate network that much of it that still dominates today. All these major industries, ThyssenKrupp Steel, Siemens, and the list goes on. They've morphed into different other organizations and entities. And yeah, that is the transatlantic network. And really that undergirds organizations like Bilderberg even to this day. So it's a really important point you've brought up there, Tony. Tony, can you speak to some of the functions of Bilderberg, the protocols, the traditions whereby there have been past presidents and prime ministers that have been invited, and they're there in a kind of subservient internship sort of function. They're being auditioned. Maybe tell us a few names and stories that you're familiar with there, because a lot of people are not going to understand that's one of the functions of Bilderberg.
Well, yeah, it absolutely is. You know, Macron is one example. Trudeau, another example. What we've got in the NATO countries really is this system for, I think, probably the best documented and most obvious are Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, who both went to the Bilderberg meeting. I mean, they're not interested in people who are in power so much as people who are maneuvering into power through the next election. And so that Blair was there just before he became the Labour leader, I believe, or maybe just after he became the Labour leader. He was also going along to these Bilderberg conferences, but he wasn't on the lists. And, you know, we found someone else this year who wasn't on the list, very important person involved in bringing Sweden into NATO, the chief negotiator doing that. They were at the conference, photographed, etc., but they weren't on the official list. So, you know, we have to take these lists as almost with a pinch of salt. Yeah, Bill Clinton again. People don't realise the guy was a Freemason. I've seen photos of Bill in his nice, you know, Masonic aprons and things. Nothing really much there out on the internet saying he was, but he definitely was. He was there at the conference just before he got the Democratic nomination. So this is the way they do things. They're really not interested in having anybody in these important, key, powerful positions, particularly because these prime ministerial roles, these presidential roles, are all about appointing senior security service staff, that those kinds of people, the people that run MI6, MI5, all these, the permanent government, they're all appointees. In fact, in many countries, of course, it's also the judiciary, are appointed by these senior figures. And Bilderberg don't want the idea of anybody who, like, I mean, imagine Jeremy Corbyn, you know, somebody like him making it into that position to be able to hire and fire security chiefs. Well, you know, we're also, of course, in the situation. Oh, by the way, RFK, you know, Robert Kennedy, who's been doing all this great work around the COVID, he sent a video message to the protest here in Lisbon on Saturday, and they had a video on. They played his little "Well done, everyone, for protesting against Bilderberg." Of course, he is a political candidate who is absolutely in opposition to this way of running things, and quite right so. He's, I think, extremely courageous to stand, considering what's happened to, you know, his uncle and his father.
And also, Tony, in terms of, you know, who carries the most weight on the steering committees, is this a constant, or does it change depending on how the economy and how technology is changing, or how the geopolitical landscape's changing? What are your views on the steering committee and the heads of the steering committee?
Well, the steering committee is really obviously what we were just hearing about, the kind of roundtable group for Bilderberg. I always remember the Economist magazine back in the 1980s published over Christmas, when they had a reserve editor in who didn't know what he wasn't allowed to say. They had a piece about Bilderberg, which I put on my own website, bilderberg.org, saying ne plus ultra, nothing above this. And they were, even in those days, they knew that this was the place where everybody wanted to go to, if they could possibly go, if they wanted to get ahead in politics. But look, as to what exactly is the steering committee up to, I think we have to understand, in the background to all of this, we've got a whole load of very key players in all of the major crises of today. Now, you're kind of missing it if you're just focusing, say, on Ukraine, as I've been doing, right? Or just on the economy, or, for example, you know, just on COVID. And by the way, the COVID featured massively. WikiSpooks did a fantastic compilation of all of the Bilderbergers involved. I think it final total was around about 130 Bilderbergers in key positions around the world, implementing the both the COVID restrictions, the lockdowns and this sort of thing, as well as profiteering from and implementing these jabs afterwards. So very, very important in those. So you could run through a list of crises. So Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, which, by the way, for many families means that it's taking they're unable to feed their kids, or they're having to work so long they cannot look after their own children. They have to sort of farm them out to nurseries and other people. So you've got the economic crisis, you've got the climate crisis, so-called, going on. We've got a migrant crisis with massive numbers of people being brought into the UK across the channel by organised crime, people trafficking going on. We've got the trans crisis in the schools, where you know, all these techniques being used to kind of prize young people who are vulnerable away from their parents and into inappropriate sexual behaviours and ideas. We've got, this is one that's hardly talked about, but the pesticide crisis. Look, these pesticides are drip, drip, drip poisoning us it just as much as some of the pharmaceutical industry. We don't often talk about that. And of course, as I mentioned before, COVID. So you've got a whole pattern of crises. And this is what I find so fascinating about studying this, is you have a look at this whole idea of accelerationism, because the accelerationists, I think it was the UK column put out, Ian Davis put out a brilliant piece about this. The idea is that the policy that they're farming out to the politicians through Bilderberg is deliberately designed to take these various crises and make them worse. So that the press, also sitting in there, they know that these things are going to be made worse, but they're part of the secret. They're part of the inner circle, and they won't talk about it. So accelerationism, I think, is very important to understand. And who is driving that? You know, what's behind that? And you could, and you, I don't know how many of your listeners know about this thing, the Dark Enlightenment, which is this manifesto, which was put together bizarrely by an old school friend of mine from Southeast London, Nick Land, who's now in Shanghai. The Dark Enlightenment is all about this ultimate creation of many crises, multiple crises, with the ultimate aim of bringing in the central bank digital currencies as all these crises come to a head, as well as this idea that actually technology is better than people, so that we will be slaves to AI, that we will become the creatures, the tools of. So you see what I'm saying? It's the Bilderberg is not just about these specific individual policies. It's about an entire plethora of policies working together towards an evil end. And that end is slavery. That end is control. That end is changing humans' attitudes that we've had over centuries now. Basically a kind of Judeo-Christian attitude of making sure that we are always giving people the benefit of the doubt, that we are always looking at the better side of people. Now the idea is zero trust, never mind zero carbon, never mind zero COVID. It's zero trust. And we don't trust anybody. Everybody is out for themselves. Everybody is avaricious, and we have to be suspicious of anyone, everyone. And so I think that is the deeper. And actually money is very important, but it's a tool to these ends. What they're doing is they're instituting a kind of, well, it's the plot to cancel God. It's a plot to cancel morality. And so that's why I think there's a lot more to this than just the kind of, you know, policy, individual policy analysis makes out. There's a very deep, dark agenda here. And and I don't think many of the people that go along to Bilderberg, like Lamy, who are about to do whatever he's told to do and implement his foreign policy of the Bilderbergs when he comes to become foreign secretary, have a clue that what they're getting themselves into. And they may, some of them, I think there was one, I think, was it Alex Karp that actually, was it Alex? I'm not sure. I think it was that he had a kind of breakdown, basically. Hasibis, the guy behind DeepMind, he had a kind of like, I can't carry on with this. And there was a few stories in the press about him just like deciding, look, I'm going to walk away. No, but you know, he's back again. And so I think some of the participants have got no idea just the depth of the evil they're getting themselves into through Bilderberg.
In terms of the luminaries, Tony, Henry Kissinger, some of the big names, the mainstays there. Is there a changing of the guard? Who's the future Kissinger?
Yes. Really good point. Really good point, because Kissinger's 100 now. I mean, personally, I think he'll come back, even if he was very, very sad, actually, to watch at the airport. This is on a private jet. Kissinger having to wait something like 15 minutes for them to figure out a way to get his wheelchair into the jet. I mean, it wasn't very well organized. But yes, I think it's pretty clear to all of us covering here that Eric Schmidt is the guy who's taking over from Henry Kissinger. They used to be very heavy on the banking with David Rockefeller, who is actually quite a nice chap to talk to, but he never wanted to answer the questions. We're now moving towards the high tech and high finance, and particularly social media companies, these kinds of people. So they are interested in controlling the narrative, the agenda. It's just like, you remember the golden age of television in the 60s and 70s, when almost anybody could make a film and get it on TV. We're now seeing that was all crushed in the 1990s and noughties. And now we're seeing the crushing of social media, the break, you know, the destroying the golden age of the internet may be over now. So these are the sorts of people that they want, I think, in there nowadays. So Schmidt represents that, very much represents that, you know, the former Google boss. And he seems to be, you know, he's on the steering committee, etc. He seems to be the guy that's kind of leading it. And Henry Kissinger seems to be handing the baton on to him, Patrick. That's the way I see it.
And I got one last question I'm going to ask Tony, then I'll hand it over to Khaleesi, who has a question for you, for Tony Gosling. And this is about the coverage of Bilderberg, Tony, because it's changed over the years. When I was first exposed to it, I was following Jim Tucker from American Free Press. your sort of quintessential sort of intrepid journalist, with his hat and his gravitas and the long cigarette holder and all that. And Jim had his sources inside Bilderberg, and he would get the agenda leaked, every year. And then Jim sadly passed away, number of years ago. But so Jim Tucker, Daniel Estulin, yourself, obviously, Alex Jones kind of came into the scene, a little bit more and more of a, in a bombastic way, later on. But, so these are the people that we knew Bilderberg, we knew Bilderberg from a lot of people like yourself and these other names. And then Bilderberg eventually published its guest list, which it never used to do. And then they started having slightly more clandestine meetings or slightly on different dates. So talk about the coverage of Bilderberg, how it's changed. Are they reacting to the public, exposing this more? Charlie Skelton is another good journalist as well. I know a lot of what I know about Bilderberg comes from Charlie Skelton's work. But can you comment on the trajectory of this in recent years, the coverage? And
well, yeah. Sure. Yeah, I mean, he was a truly lovely guy, Jim Tucker. It's lovely that you brought him up because, and he was using these very old school techniques, which many of us younger journalists need to learn still, maybe, which is to go into the hotel, conference hotel, well before the conference to chat up, buy drinks for some of the people behind the bar, et cetera, and to get groom contacts. Now, the Bilderbergs wised up to this. One of the stories that came out of the 2002 conference, for example, in Versailles through this method, through Jim, was the chit chat at the bar about invading Iraq. Now, we were outside hearing this, thinking, good God, this is insane. And of course, in 2003, it happened. We couldn't quite believe it was going to happen, but it did. And so these, when you're talking about the list of participants, as I've said, for example, Blair was at the 98 meeting. He wasn't on the list. So we've known for a long time that all sorts of people turn up at these meetings and they're brought in cars where you cannot see into the back of the car at all. The list used to put it out as a press release marked, and I've never seen a press release in all my days in journalism. What's that? 30 years now, which is marked at the top. Not for publication. And this was a clear message to the editors that this is happening, but we don't want you to publish this list. In fact, they have a little thing saying it's all, you know, completely innocent. There will be no press briefing, etc. So one of the other things, for example, about 4 or 5 years ago, we were taking photographs of their, because they'd come out from the conference to let people in, and they'd have little sheets with them, and you could see on the sheet, there's the actual guest list there. So photographing that, we'd type it up and put it up online. And they've stopped doing that now. So they're very careful about bringing any information out that we might photograph, to put online. I mean, one of the reasons they're doing their press releases now, I think, Pat, is that on my Bilderberg.org website, I every year, whatever it was, about 92 up until I stopped doing it around about, I think it was the mid-noughties, I was getting hold of a copy by whatever means from other journalists, sometimes from mainstream journalists, and just cutting and pasting and putting online a list of all the participants for every meeting. So the Bilderbergers didn't want everybody, including the press, coming to my website to pick up a list. So they created their own website, and they started putting their own lists up. So this for me was, you know, I felt this is a bit of a victory, really. I mean, this is what all I really was after starting to pursue them in the 1990s was press conference, was more publicity, at least some criticism. So, for example, that you've got, 25 politicians from Europe in there, sitting in there. And we know from the Kissinger file leaks by WikiLeaks, that Kissinger is setting up diplomatic meetings within the Bilderberg conference. We know this as a fact from his leaked cables. And so this is apolitical. And of course, the main point really to make is that it's not just the journalists that should be reporting that are in there. It's the politicians should not be there. In fact, many countries have very strict rules of behaviour that say you cannot go into such a private conflab as this, and be having private meetings with specific lobby groups. You have to register everything, and yet they carry on doing it. Really, this again is cheek and chutzpah, because there are serious. I mean, for example, this succession of Sweden to NATO, the persuasion of the European nations to get behind this NATO war, despite the fact that the Americans blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. I mean, how on earth? It's a perfect example of this NATO aim of keeping the Germans down, isn't it? That you've got the one of the chief special planning people for the German government sitting in there, and I guess they don't talk about Nord Stream at all because his government is so in the thrall of NATO and the US policy in Ukraine, they don't dare even speak about it, even though the rest of the world is pointing their finger at Germany and saying, what the hell are you doing? Why are you allowing the Americans to bomb your infrastructure and just can carry on a war with Russia, which is something like a continuation of this the Nazis' war against Russia, that Barbarossa, you know, Hitler's attack on the Russians, Napoleon's attack on the Russians. And as I was saying, Michael Hudson is saying that this is something which goes back much, much further. I would go even further and say, really, this is the, you know, you were talking about the Jesuits. This is the Orthodox Church that's under attack. The Orthodox Church doesn't allow Freemasons. In fact, they will excommunicate any Freemasons they find in the Orthodox Church because of the oath crime, which they take seriously. The Catholics don't, the Protestants don't. And this is where Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, simply let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything else comes from the devil. Never swear an oath. And the Orthodox Church actually take this quite seriously. The Catholics don't and the Protestants don't. So in a way, you can see the Ukraine war as just a continuation of this attack by Freemasonry on the Russian way of doing things, the Orthodox way of doing things. I mean, you know, I realize that's a bit out there, but I think we need to start looking in, you know, at the history of the Russophobia to actually understand why we've got this meat grinder in Ukraine now. And what appears to be insane is not insane. It's actually an evil plan, Patrick. So anyway, thanks ever so much for inviting me on. I'm going to have to dash off now. And if anyone wants to listen to our coverage, the radio show is thisweek.org.uk. And that's it for me.
And Tony, your website's still going strong, Bilderberg.org.
Bilderberg.org. Yeah. And in fact, you know, this is a mad story, but I was absolutely broke. I was squatting at the time when I first discovered a lot of this stuff. And I was friendly with a woman called Zoe, whose sister was one of Henry Kissinger's godchildren. And I said, oh, this is, and she actually wrote me out a check on the spot for, I think it was 150 quid and said, look, go and buy that domain, get a website up there, Tony. And so that's what I did. And it was Henry Kissinger's goddaughter's sister that gave me the dosh to do it back in 1996.
That's a nice story. So, also Tony's got a fantastic radio show, Bristol Community Radio, if I'm not mistaken. Tony, has been,
But I was sorry, Pat. No, I was booted off community radio during COVID because, of course, we were reporting the dangers of vaccines. We've been reporting the Andrew Wakefield stuff for years, and so the station manager just threw the show off the airwaves. But we've been carrying on. In fact, the audience has been growing steadily ever since. In fact, we've probably got more listeners now than we had in Bristol on the radio through the online program, and of course, it allows a lot more interaction. So we're still going strong, still have all sorts of, I think, interesting guests. And we still do a little bit of looking at Bristol politics, because Bristol is a Templar city. It was a Templar port, and it's still considered. I mean, we've got these people who control the city, almost the city, called the Merchant Venturers, which were set up under a royal charter in the 1500s. These were the people that financed John Cabot's trip to discover Newfoundland and North America, and there they are still going strong in Bristol. It's like having our own Illuminati in the city, and we try and keep an eye on them too.
That's right, former Tony. Stronghold of the British Empire, Bristol. A lot of people aren't aware of that, but Tony Gosling, really appreciate it. Everybody follow Tony on Twitter. Just click on his icon now, and make sure you're following Tony. just keep up with his work and what he's doing, but also on the subject of Bilderberg, any of these globalist institutions and history as well. You'll find that Tony's work is a great resource. So I encourage everybody to do that. Again, thanks, Tony, and thank you from everybody in the panel.
Okay, brother. Patrick, I just want to thank you very much for inviting me on, because it's kind of, you know, it's dark stuff, but I think, you know, someone's got to go there. And me as a mainstream journalist to come across this, listen, it's been a goldmine of rather nasty information, but I think it really explains a lot about the way the world works. So thanks very much for inviting me on, and God bless.
Thank you, Tony Gosling. Our pleasure. Our pleasure. So let's take hands from our speakers that we have up on stage. First, though, I want to go to Jay Dyer to comment on what Tony said about the Orthodox Church, Freemasonry. I think this is an area you can definitely give us some insight on, Jay.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that certainly plays a role. You know, when we go back to the time of the British Empire that I was discussing earlier, it's really mainline history that even talks about the fact that Freemasonry was really utilized throughout the British Empire as its intelligence network. So I see it as maybe not the dominant force today that it was in the 1800s, but it certainly is a way that still exists for people to network and to make those kinds of connections. And I do think there is a darker spiritual agenda for sure that Tony mentioned that I would agree with. When it comes to the lay of the land of the Orthodox Church, I think, you know, you and I did a good discussion on this a few days ago, or maybe a few weeks ago, actually, where we went into the history of the religious subversion, religious engineering, doctrinal warfare program, the history of all that. I just did an interview, by the way, for what's his name? Arkady Mamontov for Russian TV on the same topic, basically the same interview. So you can look for that. And I think we covered it really well, because Freemasonry has obviously Christianity in general as an enemy, and Russian Orthodoxy, you know, has, it's a little more complex, because under Peter the Great, you had the Freemasonry coming into Russia, even at that time, Catherine as well. So there's been, you know, Freemasonry has existed in Russia for a long time. There's been a tumultuous history. It played a role in the Bolshevik Revolution as well, being a kind of a network for Bolsheviks to plan Seven Sisters Lodge, Lenin, this kind of stuff. But ultimately, I think he's correct that when we look at the spiritual lay of the land, I think that there's even if you're not spiritually minded, the ideological differences between the West and Eurasia are still there. And, you know, that doesn't make necessarily the Chinese government or the Russian government heroes or saints or anything like that. But I think that we are coming to a head in terms of civilizational clash, right? Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, this kind of model. And I do think that there's, you know, powerful players who would like to see that clash. They would like to see higher level dialectics play out. They've been playing dialectics for a long time. Really, Marxism, socialism are based around the notion of managing dialectics, the necessary opposition. The negation is needed just as much as the opposition. And the idea is that this produces the synthesis, right? That's all Hegelian philosophy, 100%. So I think we have to start thinking past these categories. That kind of dialectical manipulation is also part of Freemasonic philosophy. It's Manichaean. Even Brzezinski characterized the Cold War as a Manichaean dialectical opposition that produces a synthesis. So we have to worry, I think, about the synthesis that comes out of this. It is not in any way going to be a Christian synthesis. And Orthodox Christianity does certainly play a role in being in the targets of the global elite, because it just stands for basic principles that don't align with globalization. If you look at Brave New World, which we just reread and did a whole lecture through on my channel in the past month, you know, going back and getting deeper even into Huxley's writings, he makes it pretty clear that the main reason that things like Christianity are an enemy is because they have institutions like the family. And he says that when we get breeding from completely divorced from reproduction, and when we have breeding solely from the state and from the coom pod or from the test tube, he says that that will be the perfect technocratic state because there will never be any more familial ties. And once you've broken the familial tie, you immediately have the god of the state, right? The technocratic state is the god because there is no more family. You don't have an allegiance to a mom and a dad because you don't have a mom and a dad. Your mom and dad were a test tube and a weird creep in a lab coat. So that's where they want to take it, and it's the end of the family. H.G. Wells said that we would end the family years ago. Bertrand Russell said the family would come to an end. Lord Birkenhead, in his famous essay, says it'll come to an end. So that's what it's about, and that's that dark agenda that he's talking about. I think that the upper echelons of serious, people into Freemasonry who are pretty much atheistic or some form of Luciferian, they have a similar ideology. So it doesn't mean that everybody in this global elite power structure has the same Freemasonic philosophy. They don't have to. They can be atheists. They can be, you know, whatever, because they all kind of coalesce around the idea of getting rid of the family, getting rid of any traditional notions of religion and culture, instituting transhumanism, instituting the Tavistock policies of literally inducing mass insanity through the Skittles agenda. That's what all of that is. Tavistock's been at the forefront of this last, 10 years openly. And, you know, going back and reading all these Tavistock texts in the past, few months has really just opened my eyes to how planned out and coordinated this is. So it's not accidental. There are forces who are not completely cognizant of what they're doing, but this is a top-down agenda. Absolutely. That's why these Fortune 100, they're not accidentally introducing policies that cause them to go broke. It's part of an agenda. And it is a dark agenda. I think that's the best explanation. That has explanatory power. That is a lot more explanatory power than, oh, they're just idiots and they don't know what they're doing and they're accidentally putting into place policies that just happen to align with the technocratic agenda. No, it's absolutely coordinated and it's studied, you see. Tavistock has been studying the inducing of mania for decades, maybe even a century. And a lot of those books, by the way, are not publicly available. My friend Richard Grove actually spent, I think several years ago, he spent $200 or $300 buying really rare Tavistock textbooks on this kind of stuff. And then when you go into the actual Tavistock doctors, these are the people that Bernays says constitute the invisible government that you don't know about. The invisible government is the people that you don't hear about. That is the people at Tavistock, Lippmann, right, Kurt Lewin, John Rawlings Rees, these doctors who formulate this policy that's toxic, that's then filtered out through the corporations via Bilderberg, via the Fortune 100, Fortune 500. Anyway, I'm ranting. But
well, it kind of makes sense. In Britain, Jay, the Tavistock Institute at the kind of forefront of gender reaffirming surgery.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
As you said, that's what really makes that agenda move is through the corporate networks. So yeah. They're the ones that create the demand and the make things trend, create style. Right. So that's absolutely looks like it makes perfect sense.
I'm going to have to run, but thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. There's Jay Dyer, ladies and gentlemen, author of Esoteric Hollywood 1 and 2. Also, you want to follow Jay's work at Jay's Analysis as well. Just a quick pivot. Oh, we haven't heard from Zwoden yet, so I want to go to Zwoden for some thoughts on this. Talking about global power structures, we're featuring Bilderberg, the WEF, the G7. Where does the power lie? And I want to go to get a comment after that from Matt Nielsen, because Scandinavia is quietly in the steering seat of a lot of these agendas through their amazing corporate power structure, which a lot of people are not aware of, which is very, very much on the global stage. But Zwoden, I'll go to you first. Your thoughts.
Thanks, Patrick. Can you hear me? Just mic check.
Yeah, we're good. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. First of all, thanks so much for organizing the space. I thought it's an extremely interesting topic. And I think the speakers we've had so far, I admit I haven't heard of them, but like I was really, really interested from all the speakers we heard from so far, Alex, Tony, Jay. And I actually wanted to ask Jay and Tony some questions before they left. But yeah, shame that they left. so quickly, but I guess I'll just I'll ask the questions here and just put some of my musings to everyone. So I was particularly interested by the theory that Tony just expounded on, kind of the origins of Bilderberg and kind of the Battle of Arnhem, that he was kind of created there. And he, to me, that's really, really interesting because he mentioned that Arnhem was a, in some ways, like an intentional defeat. And as an ethnic Pole, it's that battle to all Poles is very painful because we ended up sacrificing an entire parachute division. The first independent Polish parachute brigade was famously sent there to aid the besieged British defenders, and they were lots of them were killed. Were basically their positions, their landing positions were somehow leaked to the Germans, and basically the Germans, as they were paradropping down, the Germans were basically prepared, were fully prepared, and yeah, we suffered huge losses. So it's a very painful battle, and it was such a completely such a total disaster of an operation in terms of organization and planning and execution. The theory that it was lost intentionally just fascinates me, and I just wanted to ask Tony about more about that. But just a comment that that's actually kind of that battle, and that the losses that were incurred there were very painful. We lost the kind of the cream of our soldiery there. And these were the people who were supposed to liberate Poland from the Nazis, and they're all just killed in this senseless operation. So, I guess my question was, though, on that is, to what extent would Tony or others who agree with his thesis argue that this was intentionally lost? How was that coordinated? Was someone like Montgomery, who was in charge of the operation on the top brass, would they have known about this, or was this some kind of SSO, some kind of MI5 plot to do this? So I'd be very interested in hearing that. And so that was my first kind of question and some and thought. Second kind of question I wanted to ask Jay before he left, which is on Chatham House. And Khalees, I completely agree with you. And not enough people talk about Chatham House. It's an extremely influential institution. And there's just generally not enough people talk about the British influence, the influence that the British have and the British establishment and its intelligence services have. People make the mistake of grossly underestimating them. And the Chatham House is one of those, the key linchpins of that British institutional nexus of power. And I say this actually as someone, and this might make me a bit unpopular, but I actually used to intern at Chatham House 10 years ago. So I was there an intern in the International Economics Department, and it was very illuminating to be there, just to see how things work. I was just a lowly intern, but I got to see how things worked there and how decisions were made. At the time, they were essentially deciding who. So every year, Chatham House awards this award to the person of the year. It's a bit like the Times Magazine deciding on who should be the person of the year, and usually, you know, whoever Times chooses, it's a bit of a joke. But it's the same thing with in Chatham House. It's always the British establishment's defense establishment's favorite that gets chosen. And this was the time of the Arab Spring and where all those revolutions happening there. This was before kind of we all knew how terribly they ended up concluding, before the kind of the Syrian civil war, like kind of really got horribly bad, as the, and Libya. And instead of nominating like, you know, some people who are like, for example, workers who are protesting for their wages, like in Egypt, they obviously awarded the award to Hillary Clinton, right? Who was then Secretary of State. And this was like when I was talking to everyone, everyone's like, yeah, she's going to get it. Like this was the opinion, the establishment opinion always wins there. And just as my question to everyone is, in comparison to other think tanks, other organizations like Chatham House, how does Chatham House fit in with the international think tank nexus? Because those of you who don't know, there are other Chatham House is well known, but the Chatham House as competitors are people like Brookings Institute, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, these kinds of people who have huge amounts of funding. And what differentiates them from Chatham House is that they have a lot of private funding, a lot of lobbying that's done on behalf of, for example, the Gulf states or big contributors to Brookings. So they're more susceptible to kind of regional players, regional funding and lobbies, whereas Chatham House doesn't have that kind of funding structure. It's much more establishment focused. It doesn't get money from the UK government, but it gets its funding from various charities and donations. And the nature of these donations is very interesting. If you actually look into them, it's like, you know, very rich people just donating to them, but they're not as susceptible to these regional lobbies like American think tankers are. And my question, I guess, to everyone is, Chatham House is obviously very important, but how does their role compare to someone like Brookings Institute and Carnegie Endowment for International Peace?
Yeah, I think my understanding, Zwoden, is that Chatham House is the Anglo arm, or it's a part of the transatlantic arm with the Council on Foreign Relations, so that there are sister organizations, the CFR in Chatham House, and to harmonize foreign policy between the United States and Britain, and also to develop consensus on policies as well. And probably, I have not looked at the funding of both organizations, but I would imagine there may be some crossover on funding a little bit. Certainly, looking at the members of Chatham House and some Susan Rice comes to mind, and some of these other really high-ranking American foreign policy luminaries between administrations. So, I see you have your hand up, Zwoden. Go ahead and reply on that.
Thanks, Patrick. Yeah, I actually just reminded me that I had a follow-up question as well on this issue of the think tanks and Chatham House. And so Chatham House, I think we've established, is quite important, and, you know, I suggest, like Khaleesi said, everyone should look into their who they are and kind of what their role is. But another institution that I think is interesting to examine, and I admit I know little about, and I'd be interested in knowing more. I'd be interested in how they interface with Chatham House and the establishment and things like that, or the Trilateral Commission. I'm pretty sure a lot of you have heard of it. So a lot of famous people, or people who end up being picked for power, like the previous speakers said, are all somehow end up being members of the Trilateral Commission beforehand. So one example that comes to mind is Keir Starmer, Sir Keir Starmer, the Honourable Knight of the Realm, who obviously is an establishment lackey and did his utmost to completely destroy Corbyn and the entirety of the British left that was very strong in the Labour Party. And those of you who don't know, is a extremely thorough purge, like the likes of which hasn't been seen. And it's coordinated with the media, total media silence. But obviously, don't want to go into that. But what is interesting is Keir Starmer for years was a member of the Trilateral Commission and had links to intelligence services, to the Times newspaper, which is also, the Times is a major newspaper in the UK, and they're well known for having links with intelligence as well. So my question is, I guess, in light of this, how does the Trilateral Commission fit into this nexus of Chatham House, the think tanks, and the Bilderberg Group?
I'll answer that briefly. Trilateral Commission is invitation only. To me, it's a high level, global steering organization. So trilateral, the three laterals of the trilat are the United States, Europe, and Japan. So I think the David Rockefeller's idea there would be to control and steer the global economy and geopolitics. These are the three important nodes of control. So this was founded in like 1970-ish, Zbigniew Brzezinski was also a founding member, as was Jimmy Carter. So Jimmy and Zbigniew together, they carried on together. Keir Starmer, correct. And also the modern technocracy movement, the new technocracy movement based in Davos, led by Klaus Schwab and his people. Schwab was a, protege of Henry Kissinger. And Henry Kissinger is also an early Trilateral Commission member. Schwab. So the technocracy, the futurist component of the global agenda is definitely very strong in the Trilateral Commission, early days, because of Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote Between Two Ages, American Dominance in the Technotronic Era. And that's really seen as a Bible for the sort of the new technocracy, futurist, movement. So Brzezinski provided the vision. And this was when he was really identified by this globalist, elite committees as a, not just a really adept, student of international relations and foreign policy, but a visionary for future technocracy. And it's in his book, it provides early, inspiration, if you will, for Schwab's Fourth Industrial Revolution kind of tome, which is now in the, you know, Great Reset and everything. We're all familiar with that. So I don't know. I need to do more research on the Trilateral Commission, but it's a lot of important things have sprouted out of it. We'll go to Mats Nielsen. Go ahead, Mats.
Thank you. Before I get into your question about the Wallenberg family and the Bilderberg Group, I would just like to remind everyone that the former queen was a patron of Chatham House, and I believe her old private secretary, Sir Christopher something or another, was formerly on the advisory board of Chatham House. And I think that answers everyone's question on how highly regarded Chatham House is in the London Empire. Without a doubt, it is viewed as one of the most senior think tanks. And as for competition between these think tanks, I think it's more cooperation than competition, actually, because they more or less share the same goals. But heading over to the Bilderberg and the Wallenberg connection, it's interesting to see, if you look at the participants' database for the Bilderberg meetings, the Wallenberg family has been in every meeting since 1957, represented by one or two family members. And the Wallenberg, Jacob Wallenberg, the current main enforcer of the Wallenberg industry, is also on the steering committee. He's also a steering committee member. And I believe his grandfather was on that committee as well, Marcus Wallenberg Jr. And the Wallenbergs are also involved in the Shanghai International Business Leaders Council. They are also, Jacob Wallenberg is on the Trilateral Commission, and he's on the steering committee of the European Roundtable for Industry, and he's a former vice chairman of the World Economic Forum, and not to be forgotten, he's also on the board of both Nasdaq and the Knut and Alice Wallenberg Foundation. Now, the Knut and Alice Wallenberg Foundation is Europe's largest private research foundation. And of course, it's involved with the Nobel Industry Foundations and with the Nobel Prize organizations. So I think the Wallenberg Industries owns somewhere between 100 and 120 multinationals / Swedish companies. And I think most of you have heard about some of them: AstraZeneca, Ericsson, Atlas Copco, Saab Aerospace, Husqvarna, perhaps. There is no doubt about it that this family has been deeply involved in setting the agenda of a united Europe and with a free flow of capital within this European area. And I think I'll stop there. That's basically just to highlight one family's deep involvement in this organization over a long period of time, looking at the attendance database or the participants database. I think I can say with some certainty that it's quite unique that one family has been going from 1958 until today within the center of this organization and not being Dutch or British, because there are some Dutch and British families who have done the same. But definitely a spectacular family, the Wallenberg family.
Yeah, and that's pronounced Wallenberg if you're Anglo-sized.
Yes, of course, Wallenberg. Yeah, I'm going with the Swedish pronunciation out of habit.
Sorry, that's all right. That. So, Matt, you know, Investor AB, that's their big vehicle. They have controlling interest in so many things, including the Nasdaq stock exchange. That's a big one.
Yes.
And also, you mentioned AstraZeneca, Saab as well. And by the way, Saab manufactures the NLAW, the Javelin missile, European version, which are they flooded into Ukraine, that they stocked the British military for the NLAW shoulder-mounted lightweight anti-tank missile. Ericsson is probably one of the most important telecommunications companies on the planet. And they provide the backbone of, at least they have for many years, the NSA. And Sweden itself has a formidable data collection operation that a lot of people are not aware of as well. A lot of technologies and financial services and electronic and tech infrastructure. A lot of this is controlled from a very small pair of hands in Sweden, the Wallenberg family, as Matt said. And so when you're talking about global power, I would put this family up there on the same level as the Rockefellers, definitely up in that sort of top tier. These are people that really call the shots alongside the other luminaries at meetings like Bilderberg and fund and control a lot of things from behind the scenes. So, and most people aren't unaware of it completely because it's happening in quiet little Sweden up in Scandinavia. But do not be fooled by the fact that they're not in the heart central Europe. But yes, Khaleesi, I'm going to hand it over to you. I know you've got probably some reflections and comments too.
Yeah, thanks for that, Patrick. So firstly, I want to thank all the listeners. I know that there were many of you who were requesting the mic at the outset. So we will be opening up to take questions and bring you up to the panel. So if you'd like to ask any of our speakers on the panel currently a question, please request the mic and we'll bring you up. So I just had a question, and maybe we can come back to it once we've gone to Mayor Kate. And my question was, so we've talked a lot about the influence of all these different organizations, be it Chatham House or World Economic Forum or Trilateral Commission, you know, G7, all these different forums, these different think tanks, and how they all kind of coordinate probably different areas of policy. I still don't really understand the hierarchy, but the real question I have is the ultimate influence it has on everyday politics. So me as a citizen of the United Kingdom, we have some people here from the United States. Mayor Kate is from the United States. So we go out there to vote under the notion of democracy. What is the real influence there? Because I do not believe, and I think you mentioned it, I don't know if it was you, Zwadan, or somebody else, mentioned Jeremy Corbyn and Sir Keir Starmer. I had to laugh when you were describing him, because any time somebody calls him that, and, you know, it makes me feel nauseous. And he's the only person in British politics that literally can make me physically sick listening to his name. I just think he's, I don't know. I mean, he's definitely placed there. I believe it was strategically arranged from the outset that he would take over. And so if, and he is Trilateral Commission, as you said. So really, I wanted to ask about the influence it has on citizens and whether or not we are truly living in these broad democracies that we believe. But I'll come back to that. Let me thank Mayor Kate for joining us on the panel. And let's go to her for the question first. Go ahead, Kate. Thanks for joining.
Hey, you guys. So I know usually with like Davos and, you know, World Economic Forum, they usually have, I don't know if they're leaked or they're like public information, but you can see what like their fireside chats are about or like what topics they're covering. I was curious if anything, like if you guys went over any of the certain topics that Bilderberg was going over, because I know this year at Davos, CBDC was a big topic and like AI and stuff like that. So I was just curious if like they were covering the same topics or if they each have their own, you know, like specific topics that are different and like, you know what I mean? Cause I know they're all connected, but I was just curious what Bilderberg was, you know, what their main, objective or agenda was this year.
Yeah. We, Tony alluded to, some of these. And so what happens at Bilderberg, one of the things I understand from Bilderberg is they bring in the key, corporations and not just the key corporations, but the key people within the corporation. So, for, it could be the Microsoft head of marketing 1 year, or if there's a major merger or a major technological merger or something, or if it's, for instance, something to do with, the LIBOR, arrangement between the cartel of banks. I remember that was a big, Reuters, Thomson Reuters would then have a seminar and invite the key company players and some of the policymakers, and they would have a presentation. This is where we think, we need to change this and move forward in the next 12 months here. So it's really about getting consensus. It's about getting coordination. So it's a bit like a corporate conference, but sort of higher level with government ministers there and, you know, heads of finance and stuff like that. So think about it like, just like when you go to a corporate or industry summit, but just like amp that up in terms of the weight of the people there so that like you can go through and get a sort of a agreement of, okay, we think this is going to be happening. Is this going to work for you? And they're like, yeah. And then they have some sort of agreement there. And then they go in, then you see the thing happening 8 months later and you see it move nice, smoothly, seamlessly, largely because of maybe these conversations, happening at Bill. So no one's caught by surprise and there's no need to send the key stakeholders to figure out what the hell is Eric Schmidt talking about. No, I know what Eric Schmidt's talking about because I was there at Bilderberg last year. So it's that.
The reason I ask is because, okay, so before Davos this year, the whole Sam Bankman-Fried thing happened, and their subject was mostly CBDC. So then, which there's like a whole rabbit hole you can go down with the whole, you know, SBF thing, you know, all the people he's connected to, his family members, you know, his father writes policy for Elizabeth Warren, and, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, crypto regulation was everywhere and, you know, they had to go after that. But it felt like they had, like, I don't know, like SBF thing didn't seem legitimate to me or like naturally occurring. It seemed like very specific people were put in a place to do a specific thing, you know, in order to give, because the government always like, you know, they create the problem so they can come up with a solution. And so that's what that felt like. And at least to me, once you like drew all the lines to all of the people involved, because these people are like extremely intelligent, you know, and like anytime you'd hear an interview from him, it was just like, oh, I don't know what happened. It was weird, you know, like, I don't understand. And he just played it off like he was just so naive and, you know, unintelligent, but that the opposite of that is true. So, the reason I wondered what the subject at, Bilderberg was because of all of the AI regulation and testimony and all the falsehoods going along with that. And, you know, how they all of a sudden had this 30-year-old guy who was pretending to be a 13-year-old and, you know, the AI bot on Snapchat said all this inappropriate stuff, but they didn't include the part that like that chat bot is run by ChatGPT and that 30-year-old guy is like, you know, I think he's like the son, but he's a relative of the creators. You know what I mean? And he's part of all
Without getting into the weeds too much on all those details, the main thing to understand about Bilderberg is the coordination. So you have the heads of leading AI companies there. You know, previously it was Palantir and Peter Thiel's sort of crowd as well, the heads of Facebook, Microsoft, and all these things. But so now you have other new AI companies that are represented there. Plus you have the journalists there. So you'll have, head writers from, globalist publications like The Atlantic and so forth and major newspapers. So they're also getting an idea of how to put the narrative together, which way industry's going. You have finance there. So it's the opportunity for them to get together, like OpenAI. You have the OpenAI people there. For CBDCs, certainly, there'll be different seminars at Bilderberg. Tony would have probably given us a little more detail on that had he been able to stay longer. But I think you might be able to find some of this, if you check his website, and his work. But it'll be like, you know, a bunch of different presentations and seminars that will be held for key people. Albert Bourla was there from Pfizer. So, he would be coordinating with perhaps, you know, someone working on digital IDs and institutions that will be able to roll out some of these things. And there's all sorts of, top companies are there. President of the World Economic Forum, of course, is in attendance, along with, a bunch of other people, high level academics, finance companies, universities. The narrative makers are there, like, Niall Ferguson from Stanford University, Niall Ferguson. He's a American, Scottish, top, kind of geopolitical guy, a little bit of a neocon. But, so the narrative makers are there. The heads of finance are there. The captains of industry are there. The top tech people are there. And the kings of pharmaceuticals are there. Peter Thiel himself is there. He's a libertarian. He's supposedly against the globalists on some things, but he's there. Can have a debate about all that. And then you have a few people from China and, East-West people, but not many. And they're usually selective in who they invite. And then you have ministers, like Tom Tugendhat from Britain, who's going to be, who's a key guy at the moment. There's Bilderberg is about coordination, consensus, big strategy for the next 12 months. And that's one of the main things. In that sense, it's more organized and coordinated even than WEF. The WEF is much bigger. Much, much bigger program, more public. And there, the point of the WEF is to bring ideas out that will inform policy and create a global consensus among the bureaucratic and elites and politicians and, top corporate people. That's like Build Back Better, for instance, that came out of, Davos. So, and it timed perfectly for, the pandemic and the aftermath of it. So a little bit different than Bilderberg in that sense. I'm not sure if that's a comprehensive answer, but let's go to Dank One.
Hey, hi, Patrick. Thank you very much for having me. I have a short note and then a question. With the Bilderberger, you nailed it with, it's just a tier. For me, it's a tier up after WEF. WEF, it's like the grooming session where you get the new companies and stuff. And then you go the tier up to this policy and especially media level. Because when you look back at the topics that they had and everyone can look at them now, it was secret for a very long time, but then they had to open it with just the open topics, right? But when you just go through the open topics, you will see that usually in this year, you will find the main articles in newspaper will be around these topics that they are discussing in the Bilderberg group. And it's worldwide international media that is bringing this up. So that's the topics that will be pushed and where there will be a consent of in which direction it will be pushed, policy plus media. And my question would be about the Committee of 300, if you heard of them. That's one. And the other is, they are called as well the Olympians, but I've never found real proof or something that is solid. It's always written about them, or there are information, but it's very much in the fog. And I was just wondering if anyone here knows about them, because it is said that they are as well the ones that had in their ideas with Bilderberg and of course Club of Rome, and who the ones that know of Club of Rome, that's the guys that are very close to Mr. Schwab, who brought Club of Rome into WEF very early. And Club of Rome are two very important narratives of, first of the radicalization of feminism and the climate change. And of course, Zero Grove, that was their first work that they wrote, was about Zero Grove. And when you read that, you can go on the official site of them and read this up. And yeah, that's all. Just that was the question.
Yeah, committee of, thank you, Dan. Committee of 300. I don't know if it's still if it's still in existence or if it's just completely underground. But certainly the work of Anthony Sutton and others exposing the Committee of 300 and documenting that in an academic way. And other researchers, Jay Dyer, if Jay was here, he'd be able to shed a little more light on that. But yeah, Club of Rome, global warming, literally came out of the Club of Rome in 1976, and then made its way into, you know, the via Marie Strong and others. So yeah, well spotted there.
Can I jump in, Patrick?
Hold on 1 second. Let me just. Basil Valentine's on stage. 1 second, Basil. I'm going to quickly go to Zwoden because I think he wants to weigh in on this question that Dank had. Go ahead, Zwoden.
No, I'm happy for Basil to go ahead. I was actually going to ask a question on something else.
Okay, Basil Valentine, thank you for joining us for this forum space. Your thoughts on the topic?
Well, Bilderberg is sort of the last visible structure in the shadow government. For years, of course, people pretended it didn't exist and it was more in the shadows than it is. I mean, there's still no, although there might be journalists there from the New York Times and The Economist, the usual stenographers, there's almost no reportage from Bilderberg. The Guardian had somebody outside. They've sort of finally acknowledged that it exists and that the commingling of elected officials with corporate heads, ambassadors, etc., is questionable, to say the least. I don't think anything appears in any kind of public record. As somebody said, it's very much a grooming forum where people both in power and approaching power are sized up by Bilderberg. I don't like the term the powers that be, so whether or not they can be trusted should they be elected. So David Lammy, the Labour Foreign Secretary shadow, was there this year. He will, of course, been at pains to make all the right sort of imperialist noises and reassure them that the ghost of Jeremy Corbyn and the anti-NATO, anti-imperialist peace party in the British Labour Party is well and truly expunged and stone dead. And it has a sort of proto-Masonic structure with grades of initiation, which, although not overt, you know, nevertheless, you work your way in to these organizations and then beyond Bilderberg. Yes, the Committee of 300, the Olympians. Beyond that, we're talking about the 12 families, the secret government proper, etc. As Disraeli said, the world is run by very different people from those that the public think it is, if I can paraphrase him. You know, and even people like Schwab and Bill Gates, they are still essentially frontmen because they're in the public eye. They're there to take some flack. We don't really know. I mean, although Gates was very vocal, we don't really know who dreamed up and coordinated the whole scamdemic farrago. You know, how this global response was initiated, how the whole thing came to be inflated way, 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 way beyond the severity of any real crisis. You know, the intricate gearbox of world control remains completely occulted, and you have to look for more esoteric sources if you want to go that far. But Bilderberg is the last sort of quasi-public structure before you get into what is, of course, secret societies. They're called secret societies because they're secret. But, you know, some people have pointed to the Quatuor Coronati Lodge of Freemasonry, which is based in the city. But even just saying masonry, I said, it's far, far, far too general. Yes, I'm happy to hand over from somewhere to someone else there.
Yeah, we'll go to Swoden, but I also wanted to put some meat on the bones of what Dank was saying. This is from Anula de Viver van der Heyden. She is a Dutch official here. I'm not sure what organization she's with, but she just gave the speech a couple of days ago on degrowth in Europe. The European Parliament held a degrowth event where they brainstormed of new ways to become poorer. So hashtag degrowth. So no degrowth without hashtag decolonization. She's got her speech up here. I've retweeted this on my feed, by the way. So they had a whole conference in the European Parliament about negative growth. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. The EU is pursuing policies of scarcity now. So I'm calling this the European Soviet. I have no other way to describe it, but that's exactly what Dank was referring to out of the Club of Rome. But over to Swoden.
Thanks, Patrick. And this is more of a comment I wanted to make, an observation rather than anything else. But just what kind of Basil and everyone else has been saying, and kind of just general the theme of the space around Bilderberg, WF, Trilateral Commission. What really it does really highlight just the very intricate. Like if you think about it, it's a very intricate and well managed from a public relations point of view system of international governments that's been created. What do I mean by that is, it's a great way to have a managed democracy. So we like to think that, you know, we're told that Russia is an example of a managed democracy. You know, those who don't call it a dictatorship, they say, oh, it's a managed democracy of fake elections and blah, blah, blah. But actually the term managed democracy, it describes the West, the Western world and the neoliberal economic model, perfectly. And, this kind of semi-oligarchic structure that basically exists. And why am I remarking on this? I'm remarking on this because I think a lot of people in these spaces and kind of in of this mindset, and I myself generally as well, struggle with this idea like, oh, all our part, you know, we're presented with this idea and with evidence every day that our politicians are complete morons, right? They're making stupid decisions. They're saying really ridiculous things. You know, just look at Annalena Baerbock, you know, and the idiotic things that the German government is saying. Just look at Trudeau and his very cringe and embarrassing woke posturing, you know, where he's dressing up in an Indian attire and then lecturing, going around lecturing other countries about LGBTQ rights or whatever. You know, they look like total idiots and they don't know what they're doing. They're mismanaging the economy. They make themselves look like total fools. So the picture that not just us, but the average person has in the West, you know, is of total mismanagement, is of total incompetence. And so I don't blame people when they think that elites are stupid, that the people in charge are idiots. They don't know what they're doing. You know, people are, oh, look at Trump. He's a fool. He's a clown, right? But I think that what Basil and other speakers and just everyone else has been saying, the theme of the spaces is that that's not who's in charge, right? These are frontmen. These are frontmen who are there to kind of do this kabuki theater, do this distraction game, and actually divert attention away from the people who actually are in charge. I don't mean this in a kind of a conspiratorial way, but like, you know, there are real nexuses and institutions of power, like unelected institutions of power, like whether it's bankers, financiers, primarily, I think, intelligence agencies like the Five Eyes, who constantly coordinate with each other, who basically make real life decisions that politicians have either have to sign off on or have no idea that these are being made, right? Like, this is kind of common knowledge that a lot of the stuff, for example, with Operation Gladio in Italy, like you had elected Italian governments coming in and they either weren't told at all about the secret operations that were being done by in the name of NATO by Italian intelligence services, or they would be informed after the fact and they're like, look, just sign on the dotted line. Look, we're doing these secret operations. We're not going to tell you anymore. And I mean, just that just shows that there are these real people in charge behind the clowns, and they let the clowns kind of clown out and, you know, divert attention away from them because that's like a really effective way to kind of make people disillusioned and divert, you know, the sword of Damocles, right? The person who's really in charge doesn't want the sword of Damocles, the sword of, you know, from public opinion, the sword of, you know, the consequences that they might face from mismanagement or an economic crisis, right? It's perfect. You just get some idiot like Keir Starmer or Annalena Baerbock to do your, you know, really embarrassing, dirty political work. And if the economic crisis comes in, you know, they're gone, and you've got like a whole other group of groomed politicians, you know, from the Trilateral Commission or whatever, from like the inner network, you know, that, you know, are controllable. They're intelligent enough to know how to present themselves, but they're not intelligent enough to necessarily know how to take the real power. And I just think that that's kind of fascinating, this idea that that we all are, the people in charge are idiots, is completely false. And I think you can see this in Ukraine. There's a lot of incompetence there, like from the Western side on Ukraine. But actually, if you think about it from a game theory perspective, from the perspective of some of an elite that is paranoid about losing power, is playing the game of global dominance, these people are prepared to take a huge risk, and they don't care that lots of people are going to die, that lots of people are going to, that the entire economies are going to crash. They don't care, right? That that's what Nord Stream is going to do, that's what inflation is going to do, destroy people's lives. If you think about it, the strategy that they're playing, the West is playing in the Ukraine, I think it will fail. But the people who are in charge, the people who are behind the clowns, making the real decisions, behind the Trudeaus, behind the Baerbocks, they are playing a very high-risk game. And I think our elites are now used to playing these high-risk poker stakes games, because they're like, okay, we have a maybe 30% chance of winning against Russia. But if we succeed, that 30%, it will be an enormous payoff, the destruction of Russia and then continued dominance, an extra lease of life on the neoliberal model for at least another 100 years. And I think it's extremely ruthless, but actually, if you think about it, it's actually a very intelligent system that they've designed of control, essentially diverting accountability to these, away into these clowns, these Trudeaus, and it allows them to play these extremely high risk destructive games, and which it's actually very scary. But you think about it internally from the perspective of this oligarchic elite, it's a very fine-tuned and effective system. Putin and his government could only dream of creating this kind of managed democracy. This is kind of the West has no equals when it comes to that system of management.
Yeah.
So I just want to ask a question here, Patrick, and this is to Zvadad, because he's touched on something really interesting, and I guess it's to you as well, Patrick, the question, and to the rest of the panel. And hi Basil, thanks for joining. So you have this high risk game, as you call it, Zvadad, right? And when you use the context of Russia, Ukraine as an example, yeah, you know, you can see that it's a high risk game. They've become used to playing it. We are living in managed democracies, and I agree with everything you've said. You've pretty much hit the nail on the head. But we're talking about multiple think tanks or agencies. And my initial thought at the beginning of this space was that they're all working. And this is why I was asking about hierarchy, because they're all working towards the same end, towards the same goal. But now when you talk about it, Zvadan, and you're talking about this high-risk poker game and what they've got to gain from it, and yes, you know, these people like Starmer and Trudeau and stuff, they're selected. They're not elected. They're selected to be there to do the bidding. There's going to come a time, if it hasn't already come, where there's going to be conflict between these think tanks and these organizations, and they're no longer working towards the same goal or the same ends. And there's conflict in terms of what each of them wants or who's going to have the greatest power, because this is a power game, right? So there's got to be conflict there somewhere. This is something that's come to mind. But that's just what I wanted to place there. And if we can touch on that as we go forward, thanks, Patrick, for that. I don't know if you want to chime in, Patrick.
But... Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I thought I wanted to just answer as well as Woden's observations. G. Edward Griffin, who's the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, that's kind of one of the, you know, seminal texts about the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913 in the United States. And I asked him this question a long time ago. It was probably in 2008. And I asked him about, you know, the banking elites and central bankers and, in terms of the power structure. And he said, you have to remember they're a cartel. They're a cartel. Just like any cartel, they're a cartel. These organizations are cartels. And I think Tony and Jay, and Alex Craner, early in space, that it's about cooperation as much as or more than it is about domination. So they recognize that they're all, you know, high functioning, top of their game industries. They're making stuff happen. And so cartels fix prices, the cartels fix markets, cartels divide up the pie amongst themselves evenly, if as it were. So think of it like cartels, but there might be a gangster aspect to it as well at that level. Certainly there's probably some of that. They themselves overlap with actual organized crime, too. The organized crime is a very important component of the intelligence services. It's a very important component of the banking sector. It's a very important component of political and governments all over the world. There's things that organized crime can do that governments can't, off the books, and really make things happen. So they themselves think of them as a cartel. All of these companies, predatory, yes. Microsoft, yes. But Microsoft has to share the pie with a lot of the other big players as well. And the vaccine pie, the computer pie, or the global technology, the big data pie. The vaccine passport, for instance, or the digital ID there's other major global initiatives digitally. The CBDC, Microsoft, will be handling the back end of most of this. So, and there's that battle going on behind the scenes. I think the CBDC is the most significant development of, in terms of a modern, watershed moment of potential change, maybe not for the better, but the revolutionary upending of a money system into a new order. I think this is the most significant development, as significant as anything else in history, literally changing the concept of money and reserve banking and all of this literally overnight. So we'll see. We'll see how it develops. I'll back to you, Khaleesi. We've got a few hands popping up as well.
Thank you. I'd like to go to Mats because I know Mats had his hand up, and then we'll come over to you, Denk. Mats, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Now, I would just, in the earlier discussions about the Bilderberg grooming, I would just like to make two quick and quite clear examples. I think everyone is quite knowledgeable about who Tony Blair is, speaking about labor rights that we love to hate.
And, Mats, you've got to say it the way that Zvodan said, Sir Keir Starmer, you've got to say Sir Tony Blair, right?
Sir Tony Blair, yes, indeed I do. And he was invited in 1993, pretty much the year, I think, before he ascended and took over the leadership role and got into the role of New Labour. And interestingly enough, just as he got into power, he granted the Bank of England complete control over the monetary policy, and it became independent of government decisions or oversight. And if I remember correctly, this was made just days after his party took office in 1997, I believe. And also during the same time, Blair totally eliminated the Labour Party's nearly 100-year-old platform demanding the abolition of the City of London cooperation in favour of some vague, seeking, vaguely formulated reform policy of the City of London. And then, of course, after leaving London, Sir Tony Blair was signed on as an advisor for J.P. Morgan Chase, the biggest investment bank in the world. So there is the ascension, and there is the reward. And another of these people, which some of you may be familiar with, is Kajsa Ollongren, Prime Minister Mark Rutte's government, where she has stayed since then. And now she's one of the foremost champions of continued support for Ukraine, with Dutch F-16s and other things going that way. So this is just two people within politics that are lifted up by the committee or the Bilderberg selection committee, and then groomed, and probably Kajsa Ollengren will also be rewarded somehow once she leaves office. I just wanted to make that example, and that was basically it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mats. And also David Lammy. I mean, literally, you have to just hear the guy speak to know that he's been placed there by somebody. Do you know what? Let's just move on from that one, because
do get nauseous when you mention his name. I do too. I can't see what that Labour government is going to be such a circus. Honestly, I don't even want to think about it.
At least you've got options, Patrick. I've only got one citizenship right here. Do you know?
Well, there's always Greece and Turkey and, Damascus and Moscow.
Yeah, I might have to actually venture further out, because I look at, and you know what, when I think Tony was here and he was saying, and David Lammy, you know, he's going to be the foreign secretary. I wanted to mute him and say, please don't say that. Please stop saying that. Oh, God, we've got interesting times to come in the UK. Let's go to Denk. Denk, thanks so much for waiting. Go ahead, please.
No problem. Thank you. I would like to add to what Zvodan said, because he said something that is always very, very interesting to see. And this is how people don't understand how somebody can be leading things from behind, but never being on the stage. And it's so interesting to me that people don't see that this is possible. I mean, even if through your normal life, you always you meet someone that is pushing from behind and pushing people to do something, and he is never the one that is blamed for it, but he gets the success in some way. So I don't know why people don't never see how this is possible. It's always, how could that be? I mean, you must know these guys. Yeah, whatever. And one thing that goes there, I think we must be aware as well that we all are to some extent a product of secret society. And what I mean by that is we went through an educational system and we have values indoctrinated in us. And it's always very difficult to see our own flaws because we think that's our values, right? So we defend our values while we point out in comparison what is different now. And this is an elegant way to always be a step ahead, because we would never want to see us as a result of a manipulation through our life. And that's why it's always important to look back and see what values do we really have and where do they come from. And when we look at Tavistock Institute and what happened with the rock and roll and what not, with all these things that came, there was always a steering behind. And now to not leave it on a very evil note, I think it's always also important to see that these people, I see it more than as a power structure, because the people are interchangeable in a power structure. And the power and power system keeps itself alive and is a living thing, like the ring to rule them all in Lord of the Rings, which is the power structure. And it corrupts the people that come in contact with. But those people, they usually don't care about creed, skin color, etc. They work with anyone that works with them fine, and they will kick anyone out that is not working with them. So they don't care. But we care about our single groups and our, you know, our values. We care about that, and that's why it's so easy to steer us. I just speak of me myself. So it's easier to steer me because I care for some things, and they just don't. They can be best friends. If it works for them, it could be whatever, and it works, right? So they do it. And that's the way this whole thing functions all the time. It's not that they have one plan. It would never work with one plan. You will screw up. You can't have a plan and you go through with it. You have 10 different plans, and they are even contradictory to each other. But in the whole, they bring everything. They are oriented to their goal. So if something doesn't work, it doesn't matter, because it works still with the other in combination. And this is happening all the time. For example, when people start to be scared of the secret society, so everything is Freemasonry, and everything that got touched by a Freemason must be from the evil side. So they use that, and they laugh at us because they use it, and they bring things that would be totally good. And they say, okay, it was a Freemason. And then everyone is jumping and say, oh my God, it's evil. It's from the evil guys. And then we shoot ourselves in the legs, because we do not look into content anymore. We look at like at figures, and these figures are interchanging. And as Svodan said about the government guys, they look at Merkel. Nobody's talking about Merkel anymore. She did all this stuff. Then she was out of office. Now she does anything. I don't even know what she's doing. It's just fine. They go out and it's okay. And some lose their head, but that's only some people. So that's all.
Yes. Yeah. Those are good observations. Yeah. Very important not to get hung up on some of the kind of, you know, the dramatic theatrical character actors and so forth. They are interchangeable. Absolutely. If you go to Washington DC, you will see, Democrats and Republicans drinking together after hours, after they've been shouting at each other on the floor of the, House or Senate, and the same in Parliament. They're all in the sport and social club, knocking back pints, together. afterwards down in the basement of the House of Commons. We're going to wrap it up in a couple minutes because there's some tectonic earthquake event happening on Twitter with Elon Musk interviewing Ron DeSantis. He's going to announce he's in the 2024 election. So rather than compete with that, and also the specter that Donald Trump could open up a competing space to hijack the Musk DeSantis interview, I definitely want to have a ringside seat for that. But in summation, what Dank said and what others have said, and what Zwodin and everyone else has weighed in on, it's important to look at the big picture. And, you know, the nation state, the Westphalian nation state, is still the most powerful, potentially most powerful unit of organization on the planet. Okay. And Russia's proven this. China's proving this. And I like to harken back to something that I call, which I haven't designed yet, but I'm working on it, called the Sovereignty Index. You've heard of the Corruption Index. You've heard of various indexes. I am designing the Sovereignty Index. So how high a country rises on the Sovereignty Index depends on what it controls within its own borders, whether it controls its borders, what multilateral institutions it has to bend the knee to, and so forth. So some countries are more sovereign than others, and some countries will go to the wall to protect their sovereignty, like Russia, Syria, North Korea come to mind. Very high degree of sovereignty. You can argue about other things, but they're very sovereign. Usually countries that are sanctioned by the West are very sovereign. They don't fall under the WEF diktats. They're not going to be losing any sleep over missing their UN Sustainable Development Goal targets. However, they will play along with some of these globalist initiatives because we're in an international community and everybody needs to be at least seen to be trying to make an effort, even if they don't really, it's not really important for them. So Ukraine is at the bottom of the global sovereignty index, teetering on, you know, failed state status. So just as an example, completely subsidized by a foreign power, their military run by foreign powers, their government appointed by a foreign government. You can't get any lower on the sovereignty index than that. So when we look at Bilderberg, when we look at the guest list, when we look at the agenda, when we look at the World Economic Forum, the G7, the World Economic Forum has zero power in reality. The UN has zero power. The UN Sustainable Development, the WHO has zero power. These institutions only have as much power as their people are opting into those institutions and allowing them to dictate policy and allowing the memberships to overlap with their governments. And state ownership of industry, state stake in industry, these are also big features of a country with a high degree of sovereignty. Certainly Russia is very much at the top of that list. So they're controlling society, controlling their economy. They want to chart their own destiny in that respect, still want to trade and be a part of the international community. But there are certain red lines that some countries have where they won't cede. Europe is a good example. If you're a member of the European Union, I always say this and it's worth repeating, you've already ceded half of your sovereignty just by being a member of the EU. After that, if you're then a NATO member, you can dock your sovereignty another 20%, because it means you don't have an independent foreign policy unless you're Hungary or maybe Turkey arguably does. And then if you're in the Eurozone, again, you don't print, issue your own currency. Okay. European countries can't sign energy deals with Russia. So they're no longer in charge of their own energy. So again, Germany notching down and down and lower in that sovereignty index, like France is as well. And so this is where the Frexit movements and countries now, Holland is a good example. There's a good grassroots movement there to opt out of the WEF restructuring of the agricultural policy and supply chains, etc. So all of these things are important when you're looking at these globalist institutions, these embryonic global government institutions, like the G7, for instance. Russia used to be the G8, and Russia got kicked out. Now it's the G7. And I think the more this goes on, the less and less Russia would be keen to be back in the G8. They're making their own way and facing eastwards now. So the Bilderbergers, the WEF, they have to conform to these new realities as much as they are successful in meting out their agenda and the Great Reset agenda, hugely successful. How much traction they got with that and Build Back Better is amazing. What they did on the back end of the COVID hysteria, the global pandemic and emergency, but there's some immovable objects in the world which they have to negotiate around. India could become one of those immovable objects as well in the near future. But certainly China and Russia are, and this is always going to be a problem, as are the non-aligned countries that tend to lean left and have state ownership of major industries and infrastructure, because it means they fall out of the transnational corporate network, which is, as the previous speaker has said, it's doesn't matter what country you're from, what your passport is, what your nationality is. People in that network do not see borders, and that's definitely the vibe of Bilderberg, I think. So where the nation state is secondary. So there's a lot of interesting angles to consider on this. And I think we're going to have more conversations like this. I would love to get Charlie Skelton on, who writes for The Guardian and other great publications, who's a real pioneer on Bilderberg and really does the granular politics on the membership and what the agendas are. So we might be able to get Charlie on to have another sequel to this discussion, which I think would be amazing. Tony Gosling was amazing. Really appreciate Tony coming on, and also the other speakers. Want to thank everybody, the panel speakers, everyone who got a chance. If you didn't get a chance to get up, we apologize. We normally have a guest invitations for certain panelists that we start off with, and if we have time, we'll bring people up onto the stage, time permitting. So our apologies if you didn't get a chance to speak, but next time we'll do our best, to cycle you up. But, and of course, a big thank you to our, gracious, co-hosts, Khaleesi, and Jam, amazing. So they're working really, hard behind the scenes, and we all are, to try to patch up all of these, situations that are happening on the fly. Luckily we got Tony. Khaleesi, that was good that we got Tony. I was worried for a minute there, actually.
No, it was really good, actually. I just wish he could have stayed longer, because I think there were, you know, everyone's minds there. I could tell we're working away with questions for him. But I was looking at the comments, and so many good comments for all of our panelists, for Tony, for Mats, for Basil. Basil, as soon as you started speaking, somebody posted in one of the comments, Basil's the man. So I think if you check the comments, people have really appreciated you all joining the panel, and Tony, and joining us for this discussion. It's been a real pleasure, Patrick. Thank you.
Yeah, and also based on a lot of the topics that were raised, definitely finance and CBDC, it was raised by a number of people in the Q&A. So I think if we do a sequel to this, we're definitely going to have a focus on fintech, CBDCs, and finance. So we will assemble our panel speakers accordingly. So that will be a valuable conversation, I think, as a sequel to this. So I will work on organizing that in the coming weeks. But so we aim to do this forum every Wednesday around the same time, depending. But we'll do our best to keep that consistent. And amazing discussion by everybody. I certainly learned a lot. The recording is going to be archived, so you can go back and listen if you missed any of it. Some of the analysis was unbelievable, so especially in the first hour and a half. So I encourage people to go back and listen. It was really insightful. But with that, I want to thank everybody, for joining us. It's been amazing. And again, if you want to hear any more of this type of commentary analysis, go to our website, 21stCenturyWire.com. That's my website, and with our team. And also, we have a show on Sunday called The Sunday Wire. It's a weekly omnibus audio podcast, live radio goes into podcast format afterwards on all the podcasting platforms. Basil Valentine is our roving correspondent for culture and sport. He is a mainstay on that program, on Sundays, and which is 5 p.m. UK time, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard in the U.S. and Monday to Friday, TNT radio, 5 till 7 UK, 12 till 2 Eastern Standard, full range of topics and guests live every day. And that goes on to podcasts afterwards as well. And also on the UK column Friday, that's, digital television, and the links on my profile, ukcolumn.org. I present on Fridays there. That's an hour and a half, as well, breaking news and analysis. So those are the main venues, that I'm broadcasting on, all live, including this show. So we do, 8 live shows per week. So we'll keep this forum going strong. I look forward to the next topic and hopefully see you guys there. And I'll see you in some of the other spaces as well. I think there's a Nord Stream pipeline space tomorrow that Mario's doing. I might be speaking there and unveiling and dropping some truth bombs, on that topic too, along with Marcus, and others who you might be familiar with. But, listen, you guys, amazing, amazing. Thank you, Khaleesi. Thank you, Jam. Thank you, everybody. Have a great night, a great day, and we will see you once again.